Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
You are not alone. Some key words, four words to be precise, but very much at the heart of our next feature on Author of the Week, of course, a new insight of experience. And of course, that author is mentoring expert extraordinaire, Doug Lawrence. Doug, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much.
Excellent. It's great to connect with your good self. And as we see in the subtitle to You Are Not Alone, of course, Mental Health Matters, Take the Journey With You. Apparently a book that basically speaks to how mentoring can bring value to the support structure for mental health. So share with us part of the journey, Doug, how indeed we can actually say that you are not alone.
I'm a retired RCMP, and I, of course, went through a period of time where I was dealing with post-traumatic stress. And I was, for the most part, that journey was something that I had to deal with on my own, and there was no support structure in place. And so as time has progressed, and I've been engaged in mentoring more and more, and then doing quite a bit of research on the aspect of mental health, grief, and all of those things, it was at that time point that I saw an opportunity for mentoring to be more than what it is today, that it could in fact actually be part of, if not the main player, for lack of a better choice of words, the main part in the support structure for mental health.
Now, of course, the notion that we all stand on the shoulders of giants is something which is very clear and a key aspect of the whole system. I mean, it's worthwhile noting that you're also the founder of Talent C, co-founder of the International Mentor Community. You've obtained your Certificate of Achievement Mentoring and Certificate of Confidence Mentor from the International Mentoring Community. Why is mentoring something which has almost re-emerged as a key way of actually getting through this journey we call life?
That's a good question, because what I see mentoring as sort of being it's the person that, the analogy I would use is, it's the person that's holding that candle, that torch, that's going to light the pathway for all of us, for that matter, to be able to become the best person that we possibly can. You know, when we take a look at, you know, what is mentoring? Mentoring is a two-way trusted relationship where both the mentor and the mentee are going to learn and grow on a personal and professional basis. So it's evolving to the extent now where, instead of it being focused on, you know, I have a mentor, therefore I'm going to get a job and I'm going to go through all of that, to where now it's actually more than that, is that I have a mentor, but if I, and they may or may not help me get that job, but they're not going to tell me how to do it. They're going to guide me to be able to get that job. And I'm also starting to recognize and see that if I have a mentor, there's some other things that I deal with on an ongoing basis, such as, you know, I've worked with people who have a lack of self-confidence and self-doubt and all of that. And a good mentor will pick up on that at the very early stages in the relationship, and they will not so much provide solutions, but they'll provide the guidance that they need. One of my favorite things that I tell people is, take those yellow post-it notes and write positive affirmations on them. Stick them on your bathroom mirror in the morning, so that's the first thing that you see, how you start your day is on a positive note. And I see more and more of that taking place than ever before.
It's interesting you use the post-it note aspect, because it's something I often say to my students, that they need to actually start off their dissertation work by saying this is a first-class piece of work. And it's amazing how often it does actually work and succeed. You're, of course, a volunteer mentor with the Sir Richard Branson Entrepreneur Program in the Caribbean and with the American Corporate Partners in the United States. You worked extensively with military personnel and so on. In terms of the sense of post-traumatic stress disorder, which very much emerged over the last 30 or 40 years in the aftermath of Gulf War I, Gulf War II, and so on, do you feel as though we're making strides as a human species to actually coping with PTSD and actually addressing these kind of areas?
You know what we're actually, it's like a lot of things. It's like cancer. It's like a number of other things. It's now, because we're talking about it, we're not so afraid to sort of stay in the closet. And you know, it's my favorite analogy is, you know, I'm going to stick my head in the sand, and if I don't hear it or see it, therefore it can't be happening. So it's not an issue. And I know with PTSD, it's becoming more and more people talk about it. They may not know what they're doing or how they're going about dealing with it, but they are definitely starting to talk about it. I belong to a couple support groups here in Saskatchewan, where that's the one thing that we do is we come together and we have a conversation about, you know, how are you feeling? All those things, all those pieces that, you know, that are part of that whole journey. And I think that where we were in the past was we were just reluctant to talk about it. My grandfather was ended up with post-traumatic stress, and unfortunately, at a very young age for me, I found out that he had taken his own life because of having to deal with that. And so, you know, there's so much I think awareness now from the aspect of PTS, and you know, I could go on about that. I can talk about grief as well. People are starting to talk more often, feel more comfortable about having those conversations and not staying kind of hidden or locked in the closet.
So we raised some interesting points there. I want to bring in one of our colleagues now, who's also a postgraduate student at the University of Lincoln, where she's one of our excellent co-hosts, obviously, with the Midweek Drive. That's Anna Coscanel from Romania, of course, a country that has known its fair share of trauma over the years, but thankfully seems to have got better since you've sort of been based in Bucharest and so on. Anna, any questions for Doug that you'd like to kick off with?
Yes, I do have plenty of questions, but one that sticks to my mind is, when you are dealing with a person in your day-to-day life that has PTSD, and if it happens that person to get triggered, what are some immediate actions that you can take to minimize the damage that is done or the trigger to that person so it can continue with their life?
Good question. Good question. And when it comes to that, so we'll use the example of somebody has been triggered by something. I can use as a good example was when my wife had passed away from cancer, and for the longest time period, I couldn't drive past the hospital, because every time I did, it triggered that was her last place of being, that she was alive. And so I would actually break down, and I'd have to pull my vehicle over it sometimes to the edge of the road, because I was emotionally distraught. I was crying, and I really shouldn't have been driving at that stage, but I, you know, that's where I was. And so for me, it was, what are some of the coping mechanisms that I can put into practice or into place that's going to help me deal with those triggers, and to be able to be, you know, kind of be aware of, as I go to drive by there, this is a potential behavior that I'm going to exhibit as a result of that. And the big thing is to have a conversation with somebody that, you know, a mentor, for example, or a counselor, or somebody that's going to be able to help you talk your way through. Because what ends up happening in a lot of cases, especially with, you know, with the experience I had with post-traumatic stress, was that I kept it all bottled up inside. And as soon as I started to feel comfortable and talk about it. It wasn't the post-traumatic stress wasn't as dramatic as what it was when I first started my journey.
Could this be related to gender at all? Because, I mean, often, you know, men, traditionally, we've had to bottle up our feelings and kind of, you know, certainly have the British stiff upper lip, etc. Whereas, you know, often it's been regarded that if you're looking for emotional qualities, EQ, empathy, and so on, all very important skills, that tends to be more of a female perspective, or is that too narrow a kind of viewpoint?
No, personal experience that I had myself was that there was help there, but for the longest period of time, I just kept, you know, pushing it away, and I don't need the help. I don't need the help. And what I came to realize was, as soon as I took some counseling and we went through, you know, we went through a number of different modalities, that I ended up asking myself, how come I waited so long to ask for help? Because it helped, you know, with my triggers going past the hospital, driving by there. I got to a point where it was no longer an issue. And I was able to say, you know, that's the place that my wife passed away, that Deborah passed away. And, you know, I'm okay. I'm going to be able to work my way through this. But you're absolutely right. Most male, in fact, I belong to a male support group, and that's one thing that's quite evident. Quite evident is that a large percentage of the males that are in that group don't want to open up. And they want to keep everything bottled up inside. And so as a mentor working with that person, you want to be able to create that safe place for them to be able to have that conversation and know that you're not passing judgment, that you're there to just listen and hear and be non-judgmental.
You're working, as we said, as a support for those struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, especially with respect to people who've been transitioning from military life to civilian life. And you know, sadly, we see an awful lot of conflict in the world today. I mean, you don't have to look too far to obviously see the challenges with respect to Ukraine, Gaza, and so on, Nigeria, lots of places which are suffering from challenges within that. Is this something that we're getting a handle on, or is it just a case of, well, it's a bit like sticking an elastoplast over a dam burst? It kind of has a temporary hold, but ultimately we still really haven't solved the challenge.
No, we haven't. And you know, I turn to a lot of organizations today that don't have a support structure in place, like a plan of any sort on how they're going to deal with, you know, one of their employees who is transitioning, or one of their employees who there's something not quite right. And actually, when we start to peel back the onion skin, we see that, or we find out that it's somebody who is struggling with post-traumatic stress, or somebody that's, you know, struggling with grief, or any one of those is. And we don't know how to go about doing that. I remember I had an organization, I was talking to one of their staff, and they said, well, you know, we think that this employee, there's something not quite right. And they explained to me what, you know, what some of the behaviors were. And I said, have you provided a pathway? Have you provided the journey that this person can go on in a safe context? Because I, you know, from my perspective, I think that they need to reach out and get some help. And the only way that it's going to happen is if the organization has that support structure in place. So no, we aren't where we need to be even yet today.
Later on in this hour, we'll be speaking to psychotherapist Graham Johnston, who's got some interesting views with respect to how he's very concerned about in this whole area, which is fascinating and a key part of human existence. There are a number of people who will effectively claim to be healers and so on, and they're anything but that. Do you find, Doug, that actually sometimes whether you are faced with people who are advocating extensive hugging or rebirthing or areas with respect to that, that actually, you know, maybe we sometimes need to trust our intuition. I often say that use the term take the tummy test in terms of whether something is suitable or not for us.
I know the one thing that I always tell people when I teach mentoring is to not mentor beyond your capacity or your capability, and to always be aware of where the line in the sand is and don't cross that line. You know, don't, if the person you're talking to would be better served by a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a social worker, it's not your place to provide that type of service. But you know, as I tell people when I'm working with them and we recognize that we need professional help, I always, my story is that I will walk beside you as you seek or as you get that help. You will never, as I always put it, I'll never leave you on the island by yourself.
Do you feel that sometimes the tendency to have a lack of faith in a society which is ever increasingly apparently more secular is part of the challenge, that somehow in previous generations we'd had either a firm belief in the divine, whether it was, you know, Orthodox, Christian, Islam, Buddhism, any of the kind of lines there? Is that somehow something that maybe we lack, and maybe that's one of the reasons why we are suffering, you know, huge cases of increasing mental challenges?
And I think it's understanding, are we talking about religion or are we talking about spirituality? Because there is a place for spirituality. In fact, there's a big place for spirituality. And I've gone through, you know, personal experiences where, you know, it wasn't religion, but it was definitely, in my opinion, my mind, it was definitely spiritual in nature. And that helped me get over some of the humps in my journey that I needed to get over. And did I need to, you know, to be what we would call religious and, you know, all of those things? I accomplished what I needed to, you know, simply by the fact that it's spiritual in nature. Every night I pray. And I pray, you know, for the people that are dealing with cancer, that are dealing with, you know, post-traumatic stress. And I do that because not so much that I see myself being that healer, although, okay, we're going to go down a path here, but I did past life regression through a hypnotherapist, and we had three or four different lives that we visited. And in each and every one of them, when I was asked, you know, what is it that you do? My response unequivocally for each one of those lives was, well, I'm a healer.
Let's return to your book, of course, You Are Not Alone, Mental Health Mentors, and Take the Journey With You. You say you actually, in terms of writing it, the very act of writing it almost acted as a source of healing for yourself and actually assisted with that. Is it again ultimately down to the communication that actually it doesn't matter whether you're writing a journal, whether you're writing a gratitude list, whether you are actually speaking to somebody else, and obviously the response when somebody says, "How are you?" You really want to know? There are all sorts of things that can actually be manifested in terms of that. So what, in terms of the book itself, did that actually serve as, in a sense, part of your own therapy in actually producing it and writing it?
So two things that have become very therapeutic for me. The first is definitely writing. So, you know, You Are Not Alone provided me with, you know, some opportunities to look inside myself and sort of see, you know, is there a place that I can be of service to others who may or may not be, you know, by themselves at that particular stage. The second, and what was surprising, was podcasts. Every podcast that I was invited to come on where I got to tell my story or my wife's story was so therapeutic that it was beyond belief how how it helped and how it got so that it became easier and easier to talk about post-traumatic stress, to talk about grief. It became easier and easier. And it provided me with that solace that I needed to be able to sort of get through the next day, right?
Anna, back with yourself.
Yes. Can you hear me well?
I can.
Okay. I do have a question, but firstly, I would like to say that how you said that going to podcasts was therapeutic for you. I do believe that it's true because when my grandma died, I didn't speak with anyone and I did not want to talk to anyone, but I started posting about grief things and how to go through grief and the stages of grief on my Instagram. And I found it to be therapeutic, as you were saying, because I wasn't talking with anyone in particular, but I was expressing my feelings. So I do believe that it's really important to find the channel to channel your thoughts and feelings through that part. So yeah, I think that's really interesting and that's true. And my question would be, a problem nowadays, even if many people started going to therapy or seeking mentors and persons that are listening to them, is that people suffer, I think, from the imposter syndrome, where they think that I am not feeling well, but look, there are so many other people that are feeling worse. So basically what I am feeling is not, I am dramatic. I'm just dramatic. Do you think that this kind of feelings, telling yourself that you're dramatic, or for example, I had in my past teachers or people in my life that were telling me that I am dramatic for crying after my grandma, for example. And saying this to yourself, do you think this worsens the feelings on long term, or makes you heal in a much lower rate, rather than just seeking therapy or not speaking to anyone but acknowledging your feelings?
I would, good point. I would suggest that part of, so the journaling that you're talking about, the writing and the posting and all of that, if you're still doing that, keep doing that, because that's going to help you continue on your healing journey. The other part is that what I find is that the imposter syndrome, what I typically will do with people that I'm working with is that I will suggest to them, okay, you know, don't get caught up in the aspect of what other people are saying. Let's focus on you and you alone, so that we can help you with your healing journey, and versus, you know, letting other people have influence, unless, of course, those other people are professional help, like a counselor and stuff like that. But the average person that is, say, you know, trying to suggest to you that, you know, just move on, just continue on, you know, don't get caught up in all this sort of stuff and all that sort of stuff, I try to tell people to, let's put them aside. And let's focus on you, because you're the one that really truly matters in this conversation. And we need to make sure we're in a position to be able to move forward with your healing journey.
You co-authored with Emily Hunter, The Gift of Mentoring. And I'm particularly interested in that title, Doug, The Gift of Mentoring, because sometimes there is this line that we actually teach that which we most need to learn. It's an old line which goes back to ancient philosophers and so on. Is that something that you found in, and was that the reason you chose the title, The Gift of Mentoring?
I was, to be truthfully honest, I was influenced by some colleagues. So the content for The Gift of Mentoring came from, I was going through a process where I had written a large number of blog articles, posted it on a blog site, my own blog site. And I had a colleague who was suggesting to me that you should write a book. And I'm going, write a book about what? And he said, all the content that you have on your blog site is content that you need to share with everyone else. And it's all the content that you've put on that blog site, it all relates back to mentoring and what mentoring can do, you know, all of those pieces. And so it was basically mentoring 101, for lack of a better choice of words. And so that was, you know, that was how it evolved. And that's how where the content for the book came from. And the gift of mentoring, how I saw it was that I had been mentoring a lot of people and we were making a difference. And so in essence, it was a gift that we were able to do so. So that's how that, you know, that's how the title came to be. It was, you know, same thing as You Are Not Alone. It was suggested by some colleagues that you need to write another book and it needs to be something that focuses on mental health and mentoring and those elements. And so that's what we did.
Speak to us about Talent C. Is the founder of Talent C. What is Talent C?
It's evolved over time. Talent C today is very much focused on developing leaders. So I have a couple different services that I provide that are very much leadership focused. It's about implementing mentoring, customized mentoring programs in organizations. It's about, you know, mentoring one-on-one. So doing mentoring with the Sir Richard Branson Group, you know, with American Corporate Partners and a couple other organizations. So Talent C is about all about that. And it's now we've taken a shift in direction where now we're focusing, if I implement a mentoring program, then it's going to have a element of that support structure for mental health.
And just out of interest, I'm being a bit of a pedant here, Talent C as opposed to Talent B or Talent A, or was that just a case of you just felt you'd put the C in as opposed to any other letter?
Talent, well, the short answer is Talent C refers to talent, and the letter C is symbolic of a large body of water where individuals can reach out and ask for help and be able to, you know, go on that journey, which would include navigating, going over large bodies of water.
Who counsels the counselor? Because obviously when you're actually doing all this mentoring stuff, you can find an awful lot of material comes to you. I mean, we spoke recently on an episode of Madrid Drive with somebody who was very much involved with the quantum frequencies and frequency analysis and so on. And whatever one's viewpoint on the whole thing, I was fascinated by this whole notion of how do you actually unwind? I mean, can you compartmentalize? Are there times where you listen to somebody and say, well, that's enough of your trauma. What about my trauma? And so on.
Good point. Excuse me. And kind of ironic in that I'm part of one of the bereavement groups here in the city, and we had about 40 people that were part of the last session that we had, which I think was on Wednesday. I didn't sleep much that night. I took on everybody's energy and so a lot of the people were dealing with the loss of a loved one, and, you know, we're going through all kinds of grief. I ended up taking on a lot of that energy and for the most part didn't get much sleep. And so there's a process that I need to go through. I need quiet time in order for me to go through a bit of a clearing where I'm clearing all of that energy out, and I'm in a better place where I feel more at peace with who I am and what it is I'm trying to do. But it's definitely something that I have to be mindful of all the time, is that I need to clear that energy out otherwise it has that effect on me.
And can practices like mindfulness, actually living in the moment, as Eckhart Tolle would say, the power of now, can they actually be beneficial and useful? Or is it a case of you need to find your own way, no matter where you happen to be, you need to find your own path?
I think it's a combination of both. You know, and the reason I say that is I can try to navigate as much as I possibly can, but at the end of the day, I'm no different than somebody who's lost a loved one. I need to reach out and ask for help as well to be able to say, okay, I'm struggling and I don't know what to do or where to go or how to go about doing this. And I need help. I need guidance. And sometimes, you know, we talked about spirituality before. Sometimes that becomes part of that journey.
Anna, any closing questions from yourself?
Yes. Just one more question. I'm sorry to end the podcast on this note, but I wanted to ask you, if someone comes to you and asks you, will life go on after losing a loved one? Will I ever be the same? What do you tell them?
I tell them yes. Yeah, I tell them yes. And it depends a lot, too, on the person. But, you know, all the bereavement that I'm involved in, I see differences in people as we come more and more we come together and we talk about what it is. And we actually, the people that are part of that bereavement group actually see, I'll use the words light at the end of the tunnel, that, you know, we just need to keep moving forward, and we need to be able to, you know, manage the triggers that we may encounter, mm-hmm. and be able to just move forward with what is in front of us. And it's a difficult part of the journey.
Perhaps the almost cliched phrase I tend to employ, keep on keeping on, might be an element we might look to work through. The book, of course, as we say, You Are Not Alone, Mental Health Mentors, Take the Journey Within, available on all good platforms. It's published by Silver Dawn Publishing. And Doug, is there a third book that you've talked about? Is that sort of likely to be emerging fairly shortly?
It'll be the new year. Yeah, it'll be the new year.
Something to look forward to in 2024. Well, before we actually head off to our next part of the program, we have two final questions to ask your good self. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today?
This has been great. Absolutely great. So thank you for this opportunity.
Well, you see, that's what happens when you have Anna Coscanell putting the Bucharest opinion into the whole system. It's very important. So the next critical question is, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the near future? Would you be kind enough to return?
I would most be honored. Most definitely would be honored.
Doug Lawrence, mentor extraordinaire, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Life a little hard. heart. 2 minds that once were close, now so many miles apart. I will not falter though, I'll hold on till you're whole. Take it back where you belong and see how our lovers grow.
Well, have you ever heard of brain spotting or indeed cuddle curing? Probably count yourself lucky if you haven't, because you might well have actually ended up paying out a substantial amount for those particular therapies. Somebody who has heard of both of those and could actually basically drive a coach and horses through the invalidity of their particular attempts to actually provide genuine health is, of course, our next guest. That's psychotherapist Graham Johnston. How are you, Graham?
I'm very well today, thanks. Yeah, good to join you.
Excellent. It's great to connect with your good self, but fascinated by this particular story, which I suppose actually maybe we shouldn't be so surprised at, because ever since the days of quackery in the Wild West and snake oil and people being sold all sorts of solutions which is going to solve their problems, etc., maybe brain spotting and cuddle curing and even rebirthing, 21st century equivalents perhaps.
Yeah, quite possibly. And the frustrating thing for someone like me in all of this is that the counter side of it is that we know what does work. We know that good old fashioned psychotherapy, particularly when combined with medication in certain instances, works incredibly well. 3 in 4 people who receive a dose of therapy in their lives would recommend it to their friends. And the same number, 3 in 4, say that therapy has helped them to improve their mental health. So we know what works. I don't think that message is out there very well, but because the market for therapy is not very well regulated, there's all sorts of potential poorly evidenced techniques and interventions that are out there that people are paying really good money and are not getting good results off the back of.
Now, your own background as a psychotherapist and educator, you were director of policy at the Bowlby Centre, which is the UK's leading training institution in attachment-based psychotherapy. As you said, you must be rightly, I wouldn't say furious, but somewhat miffed that these particular non-cures are kind of out in the market, which probably people actually, if they have tried them, may be actually left with a very jaundiced view of the whole profession in the first place.
Yeah, I think it's highly likely that if someone goes to a therapist or a mental health practitioner, even if they're not calling themselves a therapist, that does a technique like cuddle therapy, that does a technique like past life therapy, and finds that not only not helpful, but potentially bewildering and expensive as well, is likely to be put off therapy for good, and is likely to tell their friends and their family that they went to therapy, they saw someone who they considered to be a bit of a quack, it didn't help them, potentially made things even worse, therefore their minds might be closed off to therapy in general, which is a great shame, because as I said before, we know that therapy works. It has an effect size almost as good, if not better, than most interventions in, say, cardiology. It works really, really well for the vast majority of people, and it's a great shame that the market isn't regulated well enough to enable people to feel confident that when they go and see someone, they're going to get really good support and help.
There is a perspective which suggests that actually, if you are suffering from depression or indeed post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, then maybe a long hug can actually help. Having said that, in many ways, that could probably actually add to the depression and the PTSD, depending on who's doing the hugging. It's something I've said for many a time. But brain spotting, claiming to tackle trauma by finding so-called brain spots in the eye. That's a new one on me. I mean, again, Graham, just talk us through what on earth came up with the notion of brain spotting as a therapeutic element.
There's all sorts of niche therapies like this. So brain spotting is one idea that you can locate certain spots in the brain where trauma is based. And it picks up on this really quite old-fashioned idea that there are certain parts of the body or certain parts of the brain where you can locate trauma and release it, so to speak. And the therapist will then focus in on that particular part of the brain and work with it and try and release that trauma. Now, they use all sorts of techniques like focusing on color and sound and other ways of doing that. What tends to be the case with some of these types of therapy, and I'd include quite a popular one called EMDR, eye movement desensitizing technique, in that is that what you do is talk about the trauma of your life, talk about those life experiences while at the same time doing something else. So in the case of EMDR, kind of moving the focus of the eyes. But what is really happening in that instance is that talking about the trauma with a therapist that's showing compassion and showing interest in your life and helping you to explore how you feel, that's the therapeutic bit. All the other stuff that gets layered on top in terms of getting your eyes to focus in a certain place or focusing on certain sounds and color is just a cherry on top, really, that doesn't have a therapeutic effect, but sounds good and often sells lots of books, right?
The Hippocratic Oath, of course, has as its foundation the notion of primo non nocere, first of all, do no harm. Is it possible some of these things? I mean, I'm looking at the next one that came up, rebirthing therapy, wrapping people in blankets to simulate the womb and then having them push their way out to be reborn. If not physical harm, I mean, again, if these are being dealt with people who are not skilled, haven't gone through your own particular training and experience, it could be, I would have thought, potentially in the category of doing more harm than good, couldn't they?
Certainly. I think the vast majority of people would go along to something like that, consider it to be a bit bizarre and walk away unharmed. But I think you're right. There is a smaller minority, a small subset of people with really quite serious mental distress, including post-traumatic stress disorder, where an experience like that might make them feel incredibly unsafe, incredibly scared, and might put them off seeking the sort of evidence-based treatment that we know works with responding to symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. We do know that 1 in 20 people that go to therapy say that their therapy made them worse than they were before. And I imagine some of the techniques and tools that we've been talking about so far are those that are practiced on those people that report, those 1 in 20 that report therapy making their mental health worse.
I mean, the field of psychology, the field of psychotherapy, I mean, there's obviously huge disputes between Sigmund Freud and Jung and elements back in the day, etc., in terms of what's appropriate. And obviously, Freud had his particular viewpoint. I always find it's a wonderful thing that Freud was closely related to Edward Bernays, of course, a key public relations guru who effectively got more women to smoke because of obviously his campaigns back in the day. So, I mean, lots of, in a sense, potential controversy from that. As I said, we're now in the third decade of the 21st century. Do you feel as though actually, through the work that you do in terms of psychotherapy as a science, as a recognized way of actually helping people, and again, we come back to the importance of actually having it regulated by the NHS, is that something which does provide at least a bit of a safety net that if people feel that whereas in times past they might have actually shared their challenges with family, they might have shared it with the church, there are a whole range of things which we can go and talk about. Maybe the psychotherapist does actually occupy that critical role of being a listener rather than effectively saying, well, okay, I'm going to cure you, and then you're done, basically.
Yes, I think that's right. I think a big task of therapy, and in the old sense psychoanalysis, where Freud would have been coming from, is to help people manage the ebbs and flows of life. Right. And I think a lot of people go to therapy for help with that they're struggling in their career, they're struggling in a relationship, they're struggling with symptoms of feeling upset about things that are not going well in their life. And our task as therapists is to not to give them false hope and false optimism in those situations. It's to help them cope with their sometimes quite complex and contradictory feelings about those events and help them to find resilience and strength within themselves so that they can manage those ups and downs of life in a relatively healthy, normal way, rather than feeling like they're moved to the extremes of anxiety and depression, for example. So in short, yeah, I think therapy is about helping, partly about helping people manage the very difficult ups and downs of life.
So what's the solution then in terms of the shall we say, more esoteric therapies, the therapists who are effectively obviously going outside the box, possibly making some substantial financial gains as well as a result of that? I mean, do we actually look for the equivalent of a professional kite mark or British kite mark registration that effectively there needs to be standards set? I'm always reluctant to kind of suggest we need to enforce yet another layer of professionalism across the base, but is that something which seriously needs to be considered?
I think so. And me and my co-author Matt Watton, we recently published a book called "A Straight Talking Introduction to Therapy," partly based on this idea, right? That at the moment you can go and see someone who you know is accredited with a certain professional organization, but that's quite different to having a regulated industry. Whereas if you went to see a doctor or a dentist, you'd know that you were seeing someone who was using tools and techniques that everyone in the industry knew were evidence-based and would have a pretty fair shot at supporting you and helping you. And we would be very much in favor of advocating something similar in the world of therapy. To, if we want to be considered rightly as a science, rightly as an evidence-based intervention for medical health, I think that a greater degree of regulation around that industry would be a good thing. It has all sorts of potential downsides that need to be teased out in the policy formulation for that to make sure it doesn't have any negative incentives along the way, but I think broadly tighter regulation would be a good thing. In the meantime, people can do their due diligence themselves to some degree. There's a lot of kind of organizations like the UKCP, the BACP, and others who will help you make as good a decision as you can in the current market to find the right support for you.
One of the things we've noticed at the University of Lincoln, certainly post-pandemic, has been the increase in challenges that students have been presenting with respect to mental health and aspects relating to that. It's a truism that effectively what we have a very stressful world at present, whether you're talking about Ukraine, Gaza, any of the kind of scenarios, the climate change. And of course, you know, the fact that we seem to have, in one sense, bounced straight back from COVID and God for that, without realizing actually that was a pretty traumatic experience globally. From that point of view, do you think that the technology has kind of helped or hindered in terms of how the therapy industry is kind of coping with that?
I think technology generally at the moment helps rather than hinders. I think it enables a lot of people in either life circumstances or geographic circumstances to access therapy who couldn't in the past. So yes. People living in relatively rural areas or particularly kind of parents, mothers with young children. So a number of my clients, for example, in private practice are people who wouldn't have been able to access therapy 5-6 years ago, before the likes of Zoom and Teams were available. There's definitely a conversation to be had about the effects of social media, of course, and how that has driven potentially driven an increase in mental health concerns. There's also a debate to be had about AI and therapy, virtual reality and AI, and the ways in which we can harness those technologies for good mental health. So I think there's a lot of potential in utilizing AI to support the clinical skills of therapists over the next 10, 20 years. It's really exciting.
Yes, I still believe that actually taking a digital detox on a regular basis to avoid doom scrolling as well is a good way.
I think with all of these things, even when you were talking about kind of the stuff that's going on in the world, I think being careful about how much we expose ourselves to the news and to images and sounds of trauma on a daily basis, that our immune systems and our regulatory systems in our bodies are not used to. Our brain is not used to having to deal with images of trauma and war and violence on a regular basis in that way. And if we're watching the 10 o'clock news 15 minutes, half an hour before bed, doesn't put us in the best mental space to have a relaxing night's sleep, put it that way.
The book is called A Straight Talking Introduction to Therapy, What It Is, Why It Works, How to Get It. It's by Graham Johnston, who we're delighted has joined us today, and Matt Wootton, of course, presumably available on all the usual platforms.
All the usual places, published by PCCX Books, but available anywhere you can get books.
It's been fascinating, I say, connecting with you today, Graham. Certainly looking at least addressing the whole notion of rebirthing therapy. It's almost been like a therapeutic session in itself, really. I feel as though we should invoice each other, perhaps.
Good stuff. Yeah.
We'll do an exchange of the whole sort of package, which is wonderful. Two final questions. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been good for you?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Well, the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to return? Will you be kind enough to come back sometime and share with us more from the world of the real science of psychotherapy?
Always. More than happy to. I'm such an advocate for good therapy that I can talk about it till the cows come home. So whenever you're free.
The weather is becoming more and more inclement. It's becoming more challenging on a standard basis. And indeed, we're just seeing a nice cold snap going through the country. So let's talk a bit more about driving in difficult conditions with, indeed, the head of motor insurance at Direct Line. That's Lorraine Price. How are you, Lorraine?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm okay. So, Lorraine, in terms of this, I mean, clearly, we're told year in, year out, be careful when you're driving, avoid driving, except when absolutely necessary. And yet, you know, certainly one still sees people on the roads. And obviously, we have evidence of this in terms of accidents and issues with respect to that, where people do ignore that. Sometimes, is it simply safer to stay at home?
It definitely is. And I think that's one of the interesting things that we found through the research that we've done. The vast majority of people do understand that when we get a red weather warning, it means, you know, it's potentially dangerous out there. There's a risk to life, and that we should avoid traveling wherever it is possible. Yet we found that 2/3 of people still said that they would go out during those kind of weather warnings. So there's definitely people out there where maybe we shouldn't be. We need to try and keep ourselves safe.
Indeed, over half of drivers, it's 51%, aren't actually confident of driving in heavy snow. And it's understandable because, you know, it is things change so dramatically. Our vision goes. You've got obviously other vehicles that might be overtaking you, etc. And certainly, if you're even if you're an experienced driver, but if you're an inexperienced driver, and I think it's interesting that over a quarter of those involved in an accident due to adverse weather were in the 18 to 34 year old bracket. There are issues to be overcome, really.
There are, and you're right. In the research, we found that the younger age groups, the 18 to 34 year olds, are more likely to be involved in an accident. Whereas if you compare that to overall, it was only 1 in 6 people. And I don't know whether that's because we've got some more cautious drivers or more experienced drivers, or maybe people that have been in those horrible weather conditions where something has happened, you know, a lorry's gone past and has sprayed you with snow and you can't see. And therefore, their caution is, I'm just not going out in it this time round.
Now, Lorraine, you've put together a list of 5 top tips for driving in snowy and icy conditions. Would you like to just briefly go through them in terms of, number one, of course, being making sure that your phone is charged, which I think these days we often might take for granted, really, but is essential.
Yeah, for sure. And there's a mix of things in the tips between being prepared and then what to do if something does happen. So absolutely, charging your phone, making sure you've got a bit of a winter kit in your car. So some layers, some water, some snacks. You know, if something does happen, make sure that you can contact people and that you can keep yourself warm and dry. And a couple of others about preparing for your journey. So your tire pressure will reduce in cold weather. It's nothing that you're doing to the car. It is just the weather. But making sure that before you go out on that journey, if you do have to make a journey, that your tires are correctly inflated for the car that you have. And then clearing your windscreen. So it's really interesting that if you don't have washer fluid in your windscreen, that is an offence. But also if your windscreen is not clear, so it's dirty or it's iced up and you're trying to drive looking through that tiny little patch in the window that has defrosted, that's also an offence, and you can get 3 points on your licence for that. So it's quite serious. The other couple of tips is just around, you know, as you pull away, try and use second gear if you've got a manual car, or the winter mode on your car if it's an automatic. And then the last one is just about adjusting your driving style to the weather conditions. So if you can just keep an eye on your speed, but also one of the things that I was told when I learned to drive some time ago is if you have a skid, you need to turn into the skid. And I didn't really know what that meant. So I've tried to, you know, visualize it in my own head. If the back of my car skids out to the right, I need to slowly take my foot off the accelerator, don't go anywhere near the brake, and turn my steering wheel to the right. And vice versa, if your car skids out to the left.
And if in doubt, probably stay at home or try and stay off the roads would obviously be an advisory as well. Lorraine, it's been fantastic connecting with your good self today. Where can people go to find out further information about these top tips and indeed Direct Line?
So all of our information is on our website, which is directline.com.
Lorraine Price, Head of Motor Insurance at Direct Line, huge thanks. And needless to say, drive safely, Lorraine.
Brilliant. Thank you, Alex. And yes, definitely drive safely.